Hello, everybody, and welcome to our UFC 270 post-show. I am John Pollock, joined by Phil Chertok, coming off two championship fights with the UFC's very first pay-per-view of the year, as they gave a $74.99 gift to all of their ESPN Plus subscribers that opted to jump in on the price increase, which I can say, as a consumer that bought this pay-per-view, I got it for a cool $65 on my cable provider, Phil.
Oh, that's great to hear. I'm glad you were able to get a discount, unlike our American friends. I guess they haven't raised the prices here yet. In due time, I'm sure.
That's nice. I don't have to sign up for a service just to be able to spend the $75. So that's nice as well. But we are not here to talk about price increases. Well, maybe we are. Maybe we'll talk about it a little later on. But we are going to be tackling UFC 270 tonight, featuring two championship fights. And in fact, we did get 10 rounds of action, an incredible fight. And then we had the heavyweight championship fight that I'm not going to say, Phil, was a bad fight, but it had its dramatic moments. It also had some moments where just nothing was happening, but I think there was still a certain compelling nature given the stakes that were involved in the fight.
Yeah. I mean, as the audience will hear when you go through your play-by-play, it was certainly lacking in action at points, but it was captivating because it was close.
A close fight.
It was close, and it came down to the wire, so.
Well, we're going to get right into things with Francis Ngannou and Ciryl Gane, which was, you know, this was carrying this pay-per-view. I mean, as we go through this, this was not exactly a star-studded affair. So really, I think your interest was largely concentrated in this championship fight, which did have plenty of story and interest going into it. A lot of it focused on Ngannou, Phil. And we talked a little bit about this on the news update on Friday, that with Ngannou, so much of the status of his contract and his future was the attention leading into this fight. And it was interesting to see how much publicity he received over the last couple of days, appearing on The Daily Show with Trevor Noah. There was a big profile on him in the New York Times, on top of just the regular ESPN coverage, but some non-traditional outlets focusing on Ngannou heading into this one.
Yeah, The Daily Show appearance you mentioned, I saw that. I didn't read the New York Times piece. I mean, I know the Ngannou story. We've been told it plenty of times. I'm sure there was probably something insightful in there nonetheless. But he presents himself very well in these scenarios. Like that Daily Show appearance, it wasn't a typical athlete appearance. It was, he could be a statesman, you know, at a different point in his life. He just presents himself very well. He communicates his ideas very well. And he's charming, engaging. And I can understand why he's, you know, beginning to get more and more appeal outside of fighting.
And the fighter pay issue is, I'm not going to say it's a mainstream sports issue, but it seems to be, like, when Trevor Noah is diving into that, you know, I think it really does tell you that this is not just a story that exists within the MMA media. It is, it has gone beyond that, when you're seeing big outlets that are covering this, and you're seeing someone that's very well spoken in Francis Ngannou to kind of outline this and, you know, speak about, you know, in the interview with Trevor Noah, it was not just himself that he is looking at, but the fighters at the bottom rung of the UFC totem pole.
Yeah. And the sports and the media, you know, they go hand in hand, and we're used to seeing top level athletes make millions and millions of dollars. And, you know, sometimes we can ridicule that idea because it's quote unquote, they're getting paid to play a game. But it is strange when the heavyweight champion of the world is only making a six-figure payday. And you know, entertainers who are also highly paid individuals, they take notice and they want to, you know, raise the bar for everyone. They want a level of, I guess, equity. I don't know if that's necessarily the right word, but people start to take notice. I mean, you know, you have Conor McGregor, of course, who's, you know, at the top of Forbes. But they're not all Conor McGregors. And as you mentioned, it's coming to light. It's becoming more mainstream. And at, UFC is a public company. They're under more scrutiny. Well, their parent company is a public company. So I think it's just going to be something that they continue to have to address in some fashion or another.
Yeah. And just the final thing on that is that it was a big focus of this fight, because going into this, based on the reporting that is out there, that if Francis Ngannou were to have lost tonight's fight, it would have signaled the end of his UFC contract, whereas a victory would trigger the champions clause. However, it's been stated by Ngannou's side that there's a termination date on his contract, that once it hits 5 years, regardless of whether he is champion or not, the contract is done with. But that clause does not come to an end until about a year from now. So I would definitely encourage people to check out John Nash's latest feature that he wrote at bloodyelbow.com. He has spoken to a lot of managers and getting a sense of some of the newer language in UFC contracts that have somewhat evolved. And if you're interested in a lot of how the pay-per-view payoffs work for champions, those details are in there. It's a really informative article that I know you got a chance to read as well, Phil. But that I think this fight it carried significant weight in, if you are following a lot of the fighter pay issue and what Francis Ngannou was going to be doing after this fight. So he wins this fight, and in theory now he still owes a fight, but there is. It's not just in perpetuity. Like, this contract does have an end date, and you could have a scenario in theory where your UFC heavyweight champion is no longer contractually obligated to you.
Yeah, it's very intriguing. One thing to note is that in his end of year interview with Brett Okamoto, and I've heard him repeat this multiple times when asked about the Francis Ngannou contract, Dana White sort of had this coy answer like, oh yeah, if he loses, he's free. But if he wins, I think he's got one more on, the UFC has a history of like engaging in prolonged legal battles with fighters. And even if the contract is super clear that Ngannou is free, the amount of time and financial resources required to, make that happen is a significant advantage for the UFC. So the next 12 months, it's going to be very interesting to see how these negotiations play out.
So we go into the fight, and the most noticeable thing, first of all, was two knee braces that Ngannou was sporting going into this. And I guess there had been rumors going around about a potential knee injury that Ngannou was suffering from. And he confirmed this after the fight, noting that 3 weeks ago, he completely tore his MCL while also injuring his ACL. So you have that to look in the immediate future for Ngannou as well, that this guy is going to have to be dealing with a significant knee injury coming out of this. Were you surprised at all, given this knowledge of kind of the game plan we saw from Francis Ngannou, that I think if you closed your eyes and envisioned this fight, this is not the Francis Ngannou playbook you would have been subscribing to, that we would see play itself out over five rounds?
Was it the game plan, or did the game plan get adjusted mid fight, right? Like, I'm sure, clearly wrestling is part of the training and they want to mix it up, but there wasn't really any attempt until it just sort of presented itself. And then when the wrestling was there, he took advantage of it.
Well, the first round was an extremely close round. Francis was going to the body and kind of closing distance to try and throw his power at Gon. You did see him go for a takedown in this opening round, but it was primarily just these two on their feet while Gon was clinching on the fence with him. This was a close round. How did you go with the first round?
I gave it to Gon just because he kept the distance and he used his jab effectively. There was two body shots, one that Gon looked like he complained was maybe a groin strike. But other than that, it just seemed like this was exactly the type of fight Gon wanted, and he was effective. And also Gon had a portion of this round where he controlled Ngannou against the cage and was just in trying to clinch with him, wear him out a little bit. And so I just thought he was more effective.
The second round was a very clear round for Gon. He was just circling, working from that side stance, threw a spinning wheel kick at one point. And dude, and Gon, who looked so tired in this round, he just, like, his mouth is open. It was not looking good in the second round. I don't really follow the in-fight betting odds swinging, but my God, that visual of Francis Ngannou, I'm selling, Phil. I was not looking too optimistic about Ngannou's chances here, but turn things around. So on most people's cards, I think had Gon up 2-0 going into the third round, and then all of a sudden Gon throws a kick and Ngannou catches the leg and just slams him down, that Daniel Cormier compares to Big Van Vader. And Ngannou gets to his back, and then for in the Thug Rose Hall of Fame of Daniel Cormier calls, "Oh my God, Francis is doing jiu-jitsu," was the line of the night from Daniel Cormier. And Ngannou is just working here. Gon gets up, landed a spinning elbow, and then it's Ngannou with another takedown. And Gon has not been a fighter that has been all that easy to take down. And Ngannou was able to take him down at will, various points of this fight. So Ngannou gets on the board here, winning the third round. The fourth round, Ngannou goes back to the same game plan, taking Gon down. Gon would try to get up, force back down into half guard. And then you see Gon against the cage and gets a knee to the chest from Ngannou, who's controlling the wrist and just delivering strikes. So Ngannou really turned things around in a big way in rounds 3 and 4. So you, on most cards, I think, had it even going into round 5.
That's how I had it.
Fifth round. I cannot say this was the most dynamic round in the world. Gon goes for a single leg takedown, and he moves to half guard. He gets the takedown, but then Gon just has some kind of slip up, and Ngannou reverses and gets right on top of him. Gon gets one more attempt here when he gets a leg lock, but Ngannou is able to escape that, getting back into half guard. And for the rest of the round, he just pretty much stayed on top of Gon. There was very little here that I thought this became a very close round, because if you want to talk about where were the most threatening moments of this round, they belong to Cyril Gon. But there was this was not a case where Gon was underneath doing a whole lot either. So I couldn't give this round to Gon, but it was a close fifth round nonetheless. I wouldn't say all that great of a round either. And we go to the judges' scorecards, and they scored 49-46, and two judges scoring it 48-47. For Francis Ngannou, who retains the heavyweight championship by unanimous decision.
I scored the fifth for Gon.
I could see that.
He landed strikes. He had the first minute, he was the one landing. He knew he had to be more aggressive. He was hitting that jab. Then he went for the takedown, which I thought was brilliant. It looked like he was going to ride out the round on top. Ngannou created enough space to change the position. And Gon, what he should have done was just go back to standing, and he fell to his back to go for this heel hook. Yeah, he went for a heel hook and fell to his back, and he never had it enough to finish it. And that was it. That's the moment, the big moment. He could have won that fight had he just, you know, obviously staying on top isn't easy, but he shouldn't have dropped back for that submission. But hey, at least he went for the win. Like, he was down. If you're thinking in your head, "I'm down, I need to win this," you went for it, but it seems so stupid in retrospect.
I think that this will be a very frustrating loss for Gon, because I think he had this fight won, and I think he just made some critical errors in this fifth round that you can certainly mount a case for Gon to win this round, but at the same time, I don't think you can really have too much anger at Gone not getting this round either.
I don't really get the 49. The I guess somebody gave the first round to Ngannou, one of the judges. I don't really see how you could give either of those first two rounds to Ngannou, but whatever.
Yeah, I mean, the first one was the closer of the two, but I think most people had the first two for Gone. So, I mean, on your card, Phil, I'm assuming you had it 48-47 for Gone.
I did. Yes, that is correct.
So in Phil's world, the new heavyweight champion of the world is Cyril Gon.
Hey, look, this is actually a lot more interesting, right? Because not that Gon's a bad fighter or not enjoyable to watch, although today was very frustrating. But because, you know, Francis loses, he's a free agent, he loses all the leverage, probably resigns with the UFC, and we don't hear too much about fighter pay unless he's able to get back to the title shot. Here, it remains a story that's going to be in the forefront of the media. People are going to continue to talk about it until we get a resolution at some point this year. So at least makes things more exciting in the MMA business world.
Well, it's going to be an interesting test as well for fans, because if you are looking at a prolonged like battle between the UFC and Ngannou, where Ngannou, and put aside the knee injury, that he's not going to want to fight this year under these terms. Like, he has every right to. He can turn down fights that are offered to him if he has stated, I am not fighting at this current amount that I am being paid. Are fans going to be sympathetic to that? Or are they going to be looking at, we want to see these fights, we want to move on with this division? Like, how much is the fighter pay? Like, the fighter pay story, it's like fans, it's great for them. Like, the UFC has so much control. They can make any fights that they want. They have such a heavy concentration of all the fighters. And once the fighters have more leverage and more power, that makes it more complicated to put some of these fights together. So it's an interesting predicament you put fans in, of like, where do their sympathies lie, towards the promoter or towards Francis Ngannou, for instance?
I don't think their sympathies lie in either place. Their sympathies lie with, I want to see John Jones and Francis Ngannou. Who's not making it happen? They're responsible, right? So it becomes the story of, is it Francis being unreasonable with his demands, or, which I think is gaining more traction, is the story is like, I'm the heavyweight champion of the world and I'm getting paid six figures up front. Come on. So I think now, what does that matter in the end? I don't think so, because as you point out, you know, the UFC has all the power. So even if the fans really want that fight, if the demands are too out there for the UFC, they're just not going to do it. So,
I mean, we've already seen the dress rehearsal for this, is that John Jones, it's like, he's been ready and he said, I want to fight at a certain level. And it's not like there's been this fan outcry that they have not met John Jones' demands to have this fight with Ngannou. Yes, it's just the division moves on to the next.
That's
thing.
Right. Now, there is something to be said about, you know, if a fighter can time it right, they can maximize their opportunity. We've seen this with Nate Diaz when he got that BMF fight. We saw it with Jorge Masvidal when he got the Usman, the first fight, right, on short notice, but got the money one. So if there really is demand for the fight, fighters can work it in their favor somewhat. But yeah, on the whole, if I don't think the UFC is going to bend to the boxing demand. It seems like they went down that path. They're not going to do it again. And so if they're not, they don't want to bend to it, so they just won't, and they'll let it die, I think.
Well, it's like, that's kind of the calculus of it. It's that if you publicly give to the demands of an Ngannou, you have every other champion knocking on your door that are going to be pushing for the same things. And, you know, it's just historically these types of battles, the UFC has a pretty good win-loss record when it comes to these like showdowns with top fighters. And they're not even incentivized at the same time. When you've got this ESPN deal where your pay-per-view money is guaranteed every month, you don't have the same incentive to make sure that your top fighters are fighting on a regular basis. Like, the train moves on, and they did so last year during the pandemic, when Conor McGregor wanted to fight, and they were just, hey, we'll wait till fans are back. John Jones, it's like, are they hurting without John Jones? It's like they have just built themselves into this amazing cushion where if a Francis wants to sit out, he'll sit out, and we'll just bring this interim title back again.
Mm-hmm. I do think, though, that there is, you know, the business ebbs and flows, right? There's times where it's super hot and you have a lot of draws, and that's right now. It's hotter than it's ever been. But if there's a scenario where it's not drawing as well, and the fact that it is, you know, there's shareholders who are pressuring, you know, that sometimes creates scenarios where the UFC does things differently, but that doesn't seem like that's going to be emerging anytime soon. So yeah, if the price is too high, they will just ice whoever it is.
Last question before we move on to the rest of the card. Does Francis Ngannou fight again this year?
No, I don't think he fights again this year. But I think he resigns with the UFC.
Okay. Brandon Moreno and Davison Figueiredo for the UFC Flyweight Championship was next. Their third fight in the past 13 months. They went the full five rounds here. This was a tremendous fight. We started things off, a lot of clinch work early on, and Moreno, at one point, he is knocked off balance, and from his knees, he is able to land this right hand on Figueiredo, and Figueiredo gets a takedown, but Moreno just scrambles right to his feet. Into the second we go, Figueiredo is going for the single leg right away that Moreno is avoiding, and Moreno is just displaying a ton of confidence here, but Figueiredo is starting to rack up leg kicks onto Moreno, which would prove very important later in the fight. Moreno is landing with his left hand, wobbles him on one of them, and Figueiredo himself is returning fire with several power strikes. After two rounds, what was your scorecard, Phil? I'm curious.
I had it 1-1. I gave round one to Figueiredo and round two to Moreno.
The third round saw a big round, I thought, for Figueiredo. There is a left hand that lands, and Moreno just rolls back from it, and then he knocks Moreno off balance with a leg kick, but Moreno comes back, big combination. There's a head kick that lands later in the round, and then Figueiredo drops him right at the end of the round and goes for a guillotine, but the round expires. Solid ending here for Figueiredo. I thought enough to win the round.
Yeah, I thought so as well.
So then we go to the championship rounds. Moreno, there was a slower output from each in the fourth. Figueiredo's just clinching against the fence. This was just, it was a very, very hard round to score. I think you could have gone either way on the fourth. And then in the fifth, Moreno got this big body lock takedown, but it was somewhat deflating because Figueiredo just got right back up from this. Figueiredo tags and drops him briefly. There's several big right hands from Figueiredo in the final minute, but Moreno is returning with these big bombs. This was a crazy finish to this fight. So I had Figueiredo winning the fifth round, and I had it 48-47 for Brandon Moreno, but I seriously, Phil, when this five rounds was over, I could envision so many different scenarios of where the scores could go. And Figueiredo absolutely could have won several more of these rounds. It was a very close, very competitive fight. And I think the only thing people were in agreement afterwards was the demand for a fourth fight between these two, that I don't think these two have overstayed their welcome yet.
I mean, who, especially after the main event, I'll take this all day.
You don't want three more fights between Ngannou and Gon?
No, not for a while. I do have to give a shout out to somebody in the chat here, Owen York. When in response to will Francis fight again this year, his response was, I'd say he's gone till November. So I think that was a good one. But back to Moreno versus Figueiredo. I gave the fight to Moreno. So I gave Figueiredo 1-3. And then the fifth round, I was really on the fence for, is really close. It was that last flurry at the end. I wasn't quite sure who got the better of it. It seemed like it was Moreno. Maybe I was swayed by the commentary a little bit. But I think picking Figueiredo in that spot is perfectly fine. So no problem with the decision. But I did score it for Moreno, giving him 2, 4, and 5.
Yeah, it was a 48-47 from all three judges. I was actually amazed that they were able to all be in agreement here, because I thought this was like, to be fair, like a really tough fight to score.
Yeah.
It was just such close rounds at different points. And like the third where,
yes,
I mean, it was going Moreno's way and like how much weight you put into just those final 30 seconds. But to me, that was enough here. I'm just looking at the scorecards here. So, the three judges, all three gave Figueiredo the first round. All three of them gave Moreno the second round. All three of them gave Figueiredo the third. And then they did differ on round four. One of them gave it to Moreno. And the last round, two of them gave it to Moreno. One gave it to Figueiredo. So it seemed that the four and five is where things where the disagreements were. So, there you go. So
five I can see, but I thought four was pretty straightforward. It seemed like Moreno knew he needed to win these rounds, but it was still close. Like, everything was close in this fight. It was very close, very competitive. You know, anytime somebody landed a shot, the other one would try to answer back. Very, very fun fight.
And you do have Askar Askarov and Kai Kara-France that are supposed to be fighting in March. Do you see them kind of taking a bit of a break from these two for the time being?
No! Or are you gonna... No! What are you talking about? Do you hear the pop Moreno got? That they want to replicate that as much as possible. You know, they were throwing the
idea of doing the fourth fight in Mexico. And I don't think you're going to get many complaints if you just go right back to this. I guess it's just you would maybe have to ask Askarov if he is okay with that, or Kai Kara-France. But they're not fighting on March 26th anyway. So they're just going to go right back to this fourth fight. It's like, it's the only fight I think people are really salivating for in this weight class. I don't think you'll get too many complaints if they do it a fourth time. Although I heard plenty of complaints when they announced this third fight. So anyway, people are fickle. That's what I'm trying to get.
You put it on the right card. We said on Friday that they can't headline a pay-per-view, but maybe they can headline a pay-per-view, not alone, but you put another fight on there in some other champ who's sort of like not as I guess it's sort of like the least luster of all the champs, but anyway, I think maybe a good co-main event. I think it could be a pay-per-view, but certainly should headline something.
So those were the two big fights. Okay, that's what you came to watch if you were ordering UFC 270. So we will quickly go through the rest of this card, which, to be fair, you got some really good performances on this undercard. This was hardly a poor show by any stretch. Michel Pereira defeating Andre Fiallo by unanimous decision. First round was Fiallo's round, and then the wheels just fell off. In the second round, Pereira woke up. This was not... this was semi-wild Pereira, but not to the extent where you're watching and you're just screaming at what is this guy doing, where he is often just like blown himself up, just getting to the cage, much less the actual fight. But he was just dominant in the second round, sliced open Fiallo's eyebrow just above the left eye. And going into the third, it was just a better pace put forward by Pereira, using his jabs, mixing up his strikes a lot. It just seemed Fiallo was just much more diminished after that first round. There was a groin strike, and then they ended with a big exchange at the end. So I had Pereira winning this 29-28, as did all three judges.
As did I. I think Pereira, what really turned the tide for him was that body kick. You know, he would do a round kick to the body, and he also had this very effective front kick to the body where he dig the toes in. And I think those just added up over time and allowed him to take over.
Four wins in a row for Pereira. It would be five, but he was disqualified against Diego Sanchez for that illegal knee.
Yeah, and a very exciting fighter. This was supposed to be a ranked fight. So I definitely think he's going to get a more notable name next time he steps in there.
Then we went to Cody Stamann and Saeed Nurmagomedov, the cousin of Khabib. This taking place at 135 pounds with our referee Frank Trigg. And there was a spinning back fist, and it's followed by a spin kick by Nurmagomedov. And he is just looking so loose in there. There's this attempt at a hip toss that doesn't quite land, but the position that Nurmagomedov gets after trying for this toss is he just clamps on this guillotine that is so tight. Stamann is tapping before he even reaches the canvas, and he submits in 47 seconds, that they noted was the third fastest submission in UFC history and the first fight for Nurmagomedov since October of 2020. So There was some crazy prop bet of Nurmagomedov getting a first round finish. It was like plus 700 to achieve this. So for anyone that took that prop,
not as good, not as good as Ngannou by decision, which it was what, a plus 1200?
Oh my goodness, plus 1200. Well, oh my goodness. I would not have been going that direction for Ngannou's path to victory. Yeah. But yeah, the thing we're going to say is like a lot of these pay-per-view cards, like we'll talk about like the winners and kind of where they are in like the overall weight class picture, like how many fights, like these fighters are so far away from championships that it's just like there's such a dramatic drop off. But I mean, Nurmagomedov looked great here, and Cody Stamann, like he's a
legit fighter, and he's, you know, you look at his losses, they're against extremely elite fighters, so it's kind of like no shame in that. So it definitely sets up Nurmagomedov as someone to keep an eye on in an already stacked bantamweight division. But to your point, this isn't somebody who we're looking to put in a ranked fight right away.
Trevin Giles and Michael Morales opened up the pay-per-view, and we just had Michael Morales, who was a late replacement here. He's 22 years old, originally from Ecuador, and he had some Giles was having some success early. He was also making his welterweight debut here. Giles has fought at light heavyweight and middleweight, and was coming off a loss, a knockout loss at UFC 264 last July. So Morales just catches Giles with this right counter, follows with this short uppercut, and then another one drops Giles, and he is on top of him with this huge barrage of strikes, and referee Mike Beltran stopped it at 4:06 of the first round. So Morales wins by TKO, improves to 13-0 in this UFC debut. So I would say someone to watch. That is the most I can say for this debuting fighter on this pay-per-view card.
Yeah, Young beat somebody with, what, 9-8 UFC fights? It's an impressive way to
seven
enter.
Fights for Giles in the yeah. UFC prior to this. Yes.
Yeah, so pretty impressive way to set things off. And yeah, somebody to look forward to in the future.
Prelims saw Jaime Barcelos taking on Victor Henry. Victor Henry, cornered by Josh Barnett, just came out and looked fantastic in this fight. This was like a really excellent fight. I had Henry winning all three rounds here, as did all three of the judges. This was just, you know, Rodriguez was very fast on his feet and had a response for everything that Barcelos threw at him, and he was able to just time out Barcelos, I thought, pretty effectively. And while the 30-27 wouldn't suggest a like, it was a very close fight, even though I had Henry winning all three of these rounds.
Yeah, I had it the same way. He controlled the action. It was competitive. Barcelos was happy to engage in a firefight and often would land. But on the whole, Henry was just sharper, took less damage, and deserved the victory.
Mm-hmm. And he said that years ago, he met Joe Rogan in a elevator, and it was a huge moment for him to be interviewed by Joe Rogan here. And Joe Rogan obviously did not remember this meeting years and years ago in an elevator.
No, but that's, you know, that's pretty cool to imagine somebody, you know, you're trying to come up as a fighter and you just encounter somebody who's like an icon in the sport. And, you know, the moment so many fighters talk about, they're just looking for that moment where Joe Rogan is interviewing them in the octagon. And then to actually achieve it, you know, come full circle, it's cool.
Yeah, and you're going to see, we already see tons of that now, where you've got a generation of fighters that not only growing up listening to Joe Rogan on UFC broadcasts, but it's like they were probably young teenagers listening to his podcasts. Like that's like the whole wave of fighters coming in now. Like this is like a huge deal for them now. Not just the UFC commentator, but this major figure.
Absolutely.
Jack Della Maddalena versus Pete Rodriguez. Maddalena is from Western Australia. And dude, this guy was very impressive. A minus 375 favorite. This is taking place at 170 pounds. Maddalena is just jabbing this guy to death. His face is just continually getting redder and redder. It's just full of blood. And he's switching stances. Dude, God bless Pete Rodriguez, but he didn't know what was coming his way. And he swings and totally misses. Maddalena just plants his feet and rocks this dude with a left hand and drops him, finishes him with several follow-up strikes, and he gets the TKO victory at 2 minutes, 59 seconds of the first round. This guy's 25 years old. He's coming off the Contender Series. Again, you're looking at prospects at this point when we're talking about someone making his UFC debut, but I was very impressed with this debut from Jack Della Maddalena.
Yeah, the level of competition obviously was not extremely high, but what he did in there, he executed very well, and the finishing sequence was very tremendous. He did sort of like this step back that lured Rodriguez in, and he was so far out of distance, then he just stepped in with the left that dropped him, sort of reminiscent of old school McGregor, actually. A very brutal finish.
Phil Chertok compares Jack Della Maddalena, a future Conor McGregor. Okay, that's the headline. Australia's own. Tony Gravely versus Simon Oliveira. They had a competitive fight here. Gravely was just the better wrestler, and that paid dividends throughout this. There was a deep guillotine in the first round by Oliveira that somehow Gravely outlasted, finally popping his head out. But it was deep, and I can't help it. I know that it's such a thing for Joe Rogan that when there's a submission, it's like the end of the world is near. It's like you can't help but be sucked into how deep the submission is. And then the head popped out, but it did look very deep.
To be fair,
like this was not one of those egregious Joe Rogan calls, but man, he just ups the drama when it's like you see a submission and he's responding like, you know, the kitchen's on fire.
Mm-hmm. Well, because that's his moment, right? He can't do the wrestling. That's Cormier's world, right? So yeah, jiu-jitsu.
Every submission is like it's over, and every groin strike needs to be viewed with skepticism. It's like you watch the replay. Yeah, that did hit. It's like he is always skeptical of a groin strike being legit or the guy's just playing. Anyway, that's what you get for calling so many Matt Hughes fights.
The groin strikes? What is that? I'm missing the reference.
Matt Hughes had like a pattern. I won't say it was like prolonged, but you could see ones where it just sounded.
Yes, for sure. Yeah,
it was no like, accident. Yes. Guy's certainly like milking the system. You could feel at times needed a little breather at mm-hmm. times. So anyway, Gravely pops out and actually does a pretty good job of coming back here. I thought it was enough to win the round because Oliveira's energy was shot after that guillotine, and Gravely was just in superior conditioning here. And it just seemed Oliveira's game plan was, I've got this guillotine, I'm going to go for this guillotine. And he continued it throughout the fight. But each time it was just diminishing returns. Gravely was able to counter the submissions and then just wrestle Oliveira. Sometimes he'd go for the guillotine and end up putting himself on his back. So when he lost the submission, he was also in a bad position. Gravely ended up in this fight getting 11 takedowns, continued this into the third round. I had a 30-27 for Gravely. That was the scorecards from all three judges. Anything to add on this fight, Phil?
No, nothing on that fight, really. There was another fight on the early prelims. Interesting.
Oh, yeah. I wanted to get to your main event with Matt Frivola. This was the fight I know that you were waiting for. Dude, this fight was insane. Matt Frivola and Genaro Valdez fighting at 155 pounds. So this fight just becomes just a firefight instantly. Frivola just gets overwhelmed. He cracks him with a left, and there's a guillotine, but Valdez gets up, and he starts throwing. And like Valdez was like right at the edge of defeat, and he gets up and he's landing significant shots here in response. It's just wild. There's knees to the body before Frivola drops Valdez with a left hand. He ends up knocking Valdez down 6 times in this round. 6 times he was knocked down. He finally just gets the mount position and finishes him with ground and pound. Mike Beltran gave them I thought this fight could have ended several knockdowns before. The reason six knockdowns in a round should not happen is because the fight probably should have ended by like three. So anyway, it went 3 minutes and 15 seconds. Frivola wins by TKO. This was a totally insane fight.
Yeah, absolutely wild, as you tried to describe it, but I don't think it does the chaos justice. Just
no.
Yeah, back and forth, even though Frivola was the one who was clearly getting the better of the shots.
And he was bouncing back from a 7-second knockout loss to Terrence McKinney last year. So that's quite the rebound to come back with this. So he gets the win, his 9th pro victory. And then the early prelims saw Vanessa Demopoulos over Silvana Gomez-Juarez by armbar at 225 of the first, and Jasmine Jazduvicius over Kay Hansen by unanimous decision. Did you see either of the Fight Pass fights?
Because yeah, I saw both of them, and they were pretty interesting. Yeah, they were pretty good. Actually, the Gomez-Juarez versus Demopoulos one was pretty exciting. Gomez lands a huge punch that drops Demopoulos immediately, and then Demopoulos turns that into an armbar finish off her back. So that was a very exciting way to get things going. And then we saw Jasmine Jazduvicius from
St. Catharines, Ontario.
Yes, exactly. A Canadian prospect. She looked quite good here. She looked really polished and seasoned. The commentators made a point that, you know, she started training a little bit later in life, but for a first UFC appearance, I thought it was quite stellar.
So how about this for an interesting, the post-fight press conference at UFC 270, Dana Uh-oh. White will not be attending.
Oh, interesting. Interesting.
That's very rare. I that cannot remember the last like pay-per-view where Dana White did not do the press conference afterwards. So. Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe he's busy. Maybe he was off to watch his advanced screening of Jackass Forever.
That's right. Yes. The entire cast in the audience.
They're doing a contest where you can watch the movie. You can get an advanced screening with the cast of Jackass and Dana White, I think.
Didn't these show a clip of like Francis Ngannou kicking somebody or punching somebody? Is that part of the movie?
Oh, yeah. He's in the movie. He was in the clip they played tonight.
Oh, very cool.
They also announced tonight that International Fight Week will feature UFC 276 at
when the, I say international, you say
I'm not playing along. UFC 276 will be Saturday, July the 2nd, which is an interesting weekend because when WWE had put out their pay-per-view calendar a few months ago, they had announced the same night for Allegiant Stadium in Las Vegas. Sean Ross Sapp at Fightful has reported that WWE also has a hold on the stadium for the Sunday night. So I imagine you would just move Money in the Bank to the Sunday night. I don't think you want to go ahead head to head in the same market with a big UFC event, which I mean, for July, like you would think like you're shooting to have Conor come back by that time.
Yeah. That seems to be what they're lining up for.
So that'd be that'll be a massive weekend if they have like a big UFC event on Saturday and then WWE just moves to the Sunday night at the stadium. And it's 4th of July weekend.
Yeah, and it sounds, you know, they're doing International Fight Week, multiple days, come out, visit, travel, you know, we're going to pretend like the pandemic's over, or maybe it will be.
Did you like when they did those weeks where they did the three straight nights of cards? Because I enjoyed those.
I did too. We were talking about that today. Like, I do think that like they maybe went overboard with it. Like, I don't know if you necessarily needed to do three fight nights in a row, but having multiple events on the same week, I thought elevated the main one that you were waiting for at the end. There was one where they did a follow up one on the Sunday once.
Yeah, that I don't know did if not that, work.
Yeah,
Was it Stephen Thompson and Johnny Hendricks that they did? And it was, that was.
I feel like BJ Penn was involved that weekend.
I covered that one. It was, it was BJ Penn in what was going to be his retirement fight. It was just really depressing. I wasn't a fan of the Sunday night one where it was like everything peaked for the Saturday pay-per-view. And then you come back the Sunday, it's like a bit of a, you know, you're ending on a lower note, then you should peak with like the biggest event, right?
Yeah. I'll tell you, one thing I do miss that the UFC stopped doing is they stopped doing the Super Bowl. Like they would always have a big event on Super Bowl weekend because Vegas is, you know, a lot of gamblers are there. And then when they did the deal with Fox, Fox had the Super Bowl first year and Fox was like, why don't you come do an event? It was in Jersey, I think, or New York. So like, so the UFC did an event that weekend, Saturday, in New Jersey. So the same location. So there was all this shoulder programming that felt really fun. But, you know, obviously they can't do that because there's not their partner anymore. But then they fell off. I think it just was, it wasn't worth their time because they're competing, right? They're competing for media attention with the Super Bowl. It seems like a waste. They don't want to play second fiddle, right? They have their own Super Bowl.
Well, that was UFC 271. As of now, they have not reported the bonuses yet, but those will be out. But just looking ahead, next weekend, no UFC event, but there is Bellator with Valentin Moldavsky and Ryan Bader, which Eric Marcotte will be watching that show, and it will be going on at the same time as the Royal Rumble. What will you be watching, Phil?
The Royal Rumble is on a Saturday, eh? I'm going to be watching, I guess the football's on Sunday. So that's what I'm watching on Sunday. I mean, maybe I'll watch the Royal Rumble. That's an event I've watched recently. I saw the last pay-per-view. I thought that one was pretty good.
Who are you rooting for in the NFL playoffs?
So historically my team is San Francisco 49ers. They're still in, they won tonight. But they offer me so much misery because they should be losing these games and they're not winning in very impressive fashion. So I'm turning all my attention to the Buffalo Bills, who I are think just
they're the feel good team. Everyone's rooting for the Bills, but
and they're playing great. They had the number one defense last week. They had an offensive performance that's insane. And yeah, tomorrow night they're playing the Kansas City Chiefs. This is the game of the week. Firepower galore. This is a fun one. Whoever wins this game is going to the Super Bowl, pretty much.
That's your prediction. All right. Well, the UFC will be back in 2 weeks. They've got a fight night card at the Apex with Jack Hermanson and Sean Strickland. And then the next pay-per-view is only a couple of weeks away. They plugged the main card on tonight's pay-per-view. It is February 12th at the Toyota Center in Houston, Texas. Israel Adesanya defending the middleweight championship against Robert Whittaker, the two top middleweights in the world. Derek Lewis against Tai Tuivasa. Jared Cannonier against Derek Brunson. Kyler Phillips versus Marcelo Rojo. And Bobby Green versus Nasrat Haqparast makes up your main card. Scanning the prelims here. Roxanne Modafferi against Casey O'Neill.
Excellent. One of your favorites. Excellent. Yeah, that's going to be Roxanne's retirement fight. She's confirmed that that will be her last fight, regardless of the result. And I like it. It's perfect. It's Casey O'Neill, somebody you want to build up. Roxanne's a name. 2022, the year of O'Neill.
Okay, last one here. There's 13 fights scheduled for UFC 271. How many will take place at UFC 271? Guaranteed two are falling apart for sure. Two. The question is, are there going to be more than two fights that fall off this card?
No,
we got 2 weeks.
No. I say no. They'll keep it together.
All these fights are going to stay in.
No, I'll say 11. 11 fights stick. In fact, 12. They find replacements for people that fall off.
Okay, fair enough. Okay. Yeah, I would take that. I'll say two fights fall apart.
Okay.
And they find one replacement. So that's the exact same as what you're saying. So no, I'll go further. I'll say three fights fall off, one replacement.
Okay. Will one of those fights that fall off be the main event and the replacement be Cannonier or Brunson? Because that's why that fight's on.
You do have is backup here, and this is not a pay-per-view main event to me, but you do have Derek Lewis in Houston, so that is probably the from a live event perspective, that's probably your most valuable piece here beyond the main event. But if that main event fell off, that would be a very depressing. I'm really excited for that fight. I can't say the rest of this main card would be. I would be parting with my $65 so easily.
Yeah, I mean, there's some decent fights. It's a better main card than this one was. But it's, again, it's...
That's not saying a whole lot.
No, but it is driven by that main event, that one.
Brunson and Cannoneer, that's a quality middleweight fight for a division that is desperate for some challengers. And I like the fact that you do have your title fight and your two top contenders fighting on the main card. So you are almost guaranteeing, Phil, that something's going to happen to one of those two fights.
Yeah.
Given how nicely it works out.
You know, I love Bobby Green's been a lot of fun, is always a lot of fun, and he's been, you know, doing well lately. So excited to see him back.
You know, and we'll wrap it up after this. Two fights I'm very much looking forward to. Main events are the following couple of weeks. Your guy Fizzy against RDA.
Yeah.
That's a really good fight.
That's a huge fight.
Beneil Dariush and Islam Makhachev. February the 26th. Happening.
Yeah.
So those are excellent main events.
Yeah. Makhachev making his run. So that fight happens, and then he's going to take a Ramadan break, and then, you know, we'll see him end of the summer, early fall, I think. And, you know, that's going to establish him as the number one guy to get a title shot.
Yeah. Cause I imagine Oliveira and Justin Gaethje fight. I mean, that could be a fight for, if you don't have McGregor coming back, I could see Oliveira and Gaethje happening in July.
Yeah.
If not earlier. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, it sounds like they want to do that for Rio in June. That's what I was reading, because the May one might be going to Jacksonville. And then I heard that they're shopping Rio for June. But there's also Usman versus Edwards out there as well. So maybe that one goes to July. They do want to do that fight as well, is at least what Ariel was saying. So.
Well, there you go, everybody. That is our UFC 270 post show. So thanks to everybody for tuning in live or listening after the fact. Always great to chat with you, Phil, multiple times this week. What is going on in your world? Anything you want to promote?
No, the only thing I want to promote is actually the Discord. So, as we mentioned on the news show, we do fight predictions. We did some today. I did miserably, but we also do predictions for other sporting events. So we have an NFL prediction pool going on right now. And, starting in a little over a week, we're going to have the, Olympics. And so we're going to have so we have a dedicated channel, and we have a lot of, server members who are located in all over the world, Australia, Europe, Canada. And so we're going to help out by running polls for all the events. And so you can come join, participate, and vote for who you think is going to win. And at the end, you get bragging rights. And maybe sorry, go on.
No, this is my ender. I can't follow this line. What are you going to do with all of the archives for the Olympic polls?
I don't know. What am I going to do?
You're going to put them in the poll vault. Good night, everybody. Thank you for watching.